From NPR and Futuro Media, it's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. And this week, the Latina who made history in an elevator.
The truth. What you are doing is allowing someone who actually violated a woman to sit in the Supreme Court.
A conversation with Ana Maria Archila, the Latina immigrant who intercepted Republican Senator Jeff Flake telling her story of surviving sexual abuse.
It was a very painful moment. I cried after because I realized, oh my God, maybe my father will hear it this way.
Also, the often invisible link in the economy, warehouses, and the people who work in them.
Warehouses just look like big blocks. But then when you actually get inside, you're like, oh man, machines, a lot of people. I wonder what they do.
Plus, my conversation with Supreme Court Justice Sonia Sotomayor. All this coming up on Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Stay with us. No te vayas. Welcome to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa.
Everybody, it's Critical. I'm playing Gobble-Stoppler Simulator 2009, otherwise known as Forklift Truck Simulator 2009. So let's get right into the game. I've completed the tutorial.
So, Maria, this is a forklift simulator game.
I guess the world is overrun with boxes and pipes, and it's up to me to stop the infestation.
It's like a video of, like, people playing, you know, people post on YouTube, like, videos of themselves playing games.
Yeah.
And then they, other people, like, love to watch.
Yeah. I don't understand why, but yes.
Yeah, it's like a whole thing. I don't get it either. But, like, this video has 700,000 views, and it's just, like, this dude talking
what?
And, like, driving a forklift around and trying to pick stuff up and, like, put it other places.
Yeah.
But what I think is funny, too, and I want to show you is, like, if you look at the comments. So people are, like, giving tips. They're like, I drive a forklift, and they don't go super fast, but it feels like they do when you're in close quarters in warehouses, maybe 35 to 40 miles per hour. Someone else is like, keep your forks low to the ground when traveling, like under 6 inches high, prevents loads from tumbling off the forks. I'm a forklift driver.
Oh, my God.
So you have all these people, like, commenting who, like, actually
drive forklifts.
And the reason I ended up watching this weird YouTube video is that I've been spending a lot of time doing research on the future of jobs and the economy.
Oh. Okay.
And in fact, I found out that a lot of our future jobs involve forklifts. And that's because one of the fastest growing industries in our country today is the industry of moving and storing stuff, especially stuff that we order online.
We're going to start our show by diving into one of the fastest growing parts of the American economy. It's warehouses. Warehouses are the in-between space that all of this stuff, from cat food to fuzzy socks, flows through on the way to us. And the industry is exploding.
Hello, Chattanooga!
In 2013, then-President Obama visited an Amazon warehouse in Chattanooga, Tennessee. And he gave a speech about the future of jobs in America, with a particular focus on getting a better bargain for the middle class.
We've been fighting our way back from the worst recession since the Great Depression. And it cost millions of Americans their jobs and their homes and their savings. And part of what it did was it laid bare the long-term erosion that's been happening when it comes to middle-class security.
Obama talked about bringing back manufacturing jobs. But he was also there in Chattanooga to highlight job growth in other sectors. Amazon had just announced that it was hiring thousands of workers for its warehouses nationwide. Now, over the next 2 years, experts are saying that the warehousing industry needs to hire over 400,000 workers just to keep up with the growth in e-commerce. So the jobs of tomorrow are actually warehouse work. And many of those jobs will be held by Latinos and Latinas. Currently, about 40% of 18 to 34-year-olds working in the warehousing business are Latinos. But are these jobs that are taking over, are they really good jobs? I mean, Are they really a path to a stable middle-class life the way that manufacturing jobs once were? Latino USA producer Sofia Paliza Carr is going to explore the world of warehouses, and she's going to take us inside a high school that sees this booming industry as an opportunity for its students.
Patterson is this place in the California Central Valley. It's almost close enough to be like a satellite suburb of San Francisco. It's about an hour and a half away. All around it are fields, orchards, and it's known as the apricot capital of the world. In the 70s, 40% of the nation's apricots were grown right here. But today, as you drive into town from the elevated highway, you'll see something different. You'll see these vast, seemingly unending low and flat buildings, warehouses. There's a warehouse for Kohl's, for CVS, for Restoration Hardware, and for Amazon. They've all been built in the last 12 years, literally built on land that used to be orchards. And one of the local high schools, Patterson High School, has taken notice. They spent $2.5 million to build a 10,000-square-foot mock warehouse on school campus. And inside, they've got conveyor belts and aisles of shelves and virtual reality forklifts. All of this to help teach high school students what it's like to work in a real warehouse, like those right out by the highway. On top of taking English or algebra or photography classes, students at Patterson can take Introduction to Logistics and Forklift Driving. The warehouse is fully stocked. It's got a robotic arm that's one-tenth the scale of a real one, and students can learn how to program it to pick up and put down pallets of stuff. There's a bunch of real forklifts and machines out back. But before students can drive those, they have to learn on the virtual reality forklifts.
Straight up, don't push forward.
There you go. Hilario Garcia teaches the forklift classes.
Turn your steering wheel the other way. No, the other way. Washa, míralo.
He goes by Larry. And for a guy that spends a lot of time talking about workplace safety, he's real jokey.
The fall's not going to hurt you. It's the landing that's going to hurt.
Larry's got a gray goatee and transition lenses. He's been working in warehouses for 25 years.
This is the last thing I ever dreamed about doing was being a teacher. That's the last thing I'd ever dreamed I would be.
The virtual reality forklifts that he has students on today, they look like car racing games that you'd see at an arcade. There's a driver's chair and controls.
Bart, you logging in?
Yeah.
Okay. And then, Jackie, you're going...
16-year-old Jacqueline Mendoza is in Larry's class. She sits in one of the chairs and puts on the visor.
It tells me to turn on the key, and you see, as you can see, the key is highlighted. And you turn it, and you start the engine.
The headset makes it totally immersive, and there are speakers right by your ears that get across all the rumblings and the beeps. And the program brings up different challenges. It sets up cones for you to drive around, and at a certain point, digital people start walking around. Distractions.
People just show up on your...
Yeah, they're walking like side to side, yeah, for you to get like comfortable people walking around you, because in the warehouse, there's people walking around.
What happens if you hit one of the people?
Yeah, you fail.
Jackie heard about this class from a former student and decided it sounded like a good job opportunity. A few students I talked to had actually heard about this class, word of mouth, and many of them were expecting good jobs after graduation. Patterson High School is about 70% Latino, and it's a pretty low-income community. 75% of Patterson students are on reduced and free lunch. So a warehouse job that pays $11 to maybe $16 an hour right after graduation, that's attractive. It's much better than working in fast food. As he shows me around, Larry insists that I try out the order picker machine. It's like a lift designed to help you reach the highest shelves in a warehouse.
Okay. Don't put your foot down. Let it go up.
Okay.
Let it bring you down. That's the only one you gotta worry about.
He harnesses me in and sends me up. Just a casual three stories high.
Does it keep going?
More? All the kids down below were laughing at me. Larry thinks all these machines, all this training, it's definitely worth it for Patterson students.
The jobs that are needed right now in this industry is going to blow up by 2020.
Nationally, the warehousing industry is projected to employ nearly 4.8 million people by 2024. And there are even more distribution centers planned for Patterson. Larry grew up in Merced, a town nearby. And as a young man growing up in the 80s, one day he got a phone call from a large printing warehouse in the area.
I graduated from high school. They said, hey, thank you very much. Because I remember him calling me that day. It was just stuck. And asked me, hey, Larry, I got a job for you. If you, you know, I said, no, I'm cool. And he says, no, I got a full-time job, benefits and everything. Mom's looking at me like, yeah, you better take it.
He started immediately on the night shift. And he still dreams about that job.
I have nightmares of paper.
Like what kind of nightmares? Like they're falling.
Oh, yeah, paper falling on you. And then when you worked in the baler room, all the waste paper comes to the baler room. So I always felt about, always had a nightmare about falling in the compactor.
Warehouses are booming now, but of course, it's not a brand new industry. When World War II broke out, Americans needed to quickly move goods overseas, and they needed a warehouse system to do it. Then the private industry followed, helped by the development of the highway system. Think about how hard it was to maintain inventory and move millions of things across the country, all without a computer. So while the industry used to be all about storing stuff, now it's all about fulfilling online orders and replacing traditional retail. The school's hope is that after graduation, these kids get jobs in the industry. And some of them actually have, like Manny Olivares. He graduated from Patterson High School in 2018. I meet him really early in the morning, right before his shift at a warehouse for Crate and Barrel. He's chilling in his car, a Chrysler 300 with tinted windows.
Thank you.
What year is this?
2016. I did the headlights. I did modifications on the engine.
He's trying to wake up still, eating an English muffin.
I always keep it chill in the morning. Because if I eat too much, my stomach starts to hurt, so I have to stop working.
Manny is 18. He's got a really sweet face and smile, braces, and a tattoo of his last name, Olivares, across his forearm. His shift starts at 7 a.m. Once he clocks in, he stretches and hears from his boss how many items he moved yesterday and how many he'll need to get today.
The only gear I bring is just a box cutter. I bring a pen with me, and that's pretty much it. Oh, and gloves. Dust collects all the way at the very top of the racks. When I'm picking items, I'll just like lean over or something, and then my whole arm's black. So
before the Patterson warehouse program, Manny thought that he'd probably end up doing the kind of work other people in his family did. Like construction.
It was basically like a guide that I have to follow. If not, that would have been there or the fields, basically.
Like a lot of kids around here, Manny worked picking peaches when he was younger. And he knew he never wanted to do that again.
To work inside so much better than outside. Warehouses just look like big blocks. But then when you actually get inside, you're like, oh man, like this is pretty big. You know, it has a lot of things, a lot of machines, a lot of people.
Manny is doing exactly what Patterson's warehouse program hoped to set him up for. He got a good full-time job in a warehouse right after graduation. But it turns out a full-time job in a warehouse isn't always a given. And the future of these jobs may actually be kind of precarious.
Coming up, we visit a high-tech Amazon warehouse and meet a few of our future robot overlords. Stay with us, no te vayas.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and from The Jacob and Valeria Langloth Foundation, supporting the health and well-being of underserved populations at langloth.org. And from Cancer Treatment Centers of America, offering immunotherapy and other personalized treatment options to address patients' individual needs. More about precision cancer treatment at cancercenter.com.
Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. And before the break, we heard from high school students who were learning to drive forklifts and how to organize inventory in order to prepare them for working in warehouses. Now, our producer, Sofia Paliza Carr, is taking us to a real warehouse where these young people might work one day.
If you remember, Patterson, California has all of these warehouses over by the highway, and it's a perfect place for them. It's empty, flat, and just a quick hour and a half to San Francisco. One of those warehouses is Amazon's. I reached out to them to see if I could come take a look around, and they said yes. And visiting the facility gave me a sense of what the future of warehousing will actually look like as e-commerce grows, especially when it comes to increased automation. As I enter the building, there's just this wall of turnstiles, floor to ceiling, the kind that you see in the New York City subway. And there are signs everywhere that say no photos. Once a guard lets me in, I realize it's break time. Tons of employees are streaming out through the airport security-style scanners that they have.
This fulfillment center is just under 1 million square feet. We also employ more than 800 full-time associates.
I get a tour of the facility from Danny Tafoya, who introduced herself as a community specialist. I'm not sure what that means. In fact, there's a lot of Amazon-specific language I hear on my tour. Amazon calls their warehouses fulfillment centers. They call all their workers associates. Entry-level jobs are known as Tier 1. And over again, I keep hearing the phrase, fulfilling our customer promise.
To fulfill our customer promise.
Walking around, there are stop signs in a lot of places and lines on the ground, like roads, which is good because...
I'm just going to stop you for the crosswalk real quick. And we're good to cross. Machines that actually drove past us. I'm hoping we'll see another one in a minute. We call them AGVs.
AGVs. Automatic Guided Vehicles. Basically, it's like a forklift loaded up with items, but it's totally unmanned, and it follows a map of the warehouse floor programmed into it. It just whooshes by us. No problem. Everything in this warehouse is yellow and gray, except for another kind of robot that works here. They're bright orange.
When you think of robots, this isn't always what people have in mind.
This is Lauren Lynch, who does communications for Amazon. They're not person-shaped robots, more like big orange Roombas. They're squarish, and on top of each of them is a set of shelves, which holds items.
Operate in this perfect choreographed concert of efficiency.
So this is how it works. Say somebody really wants to order a back massager. They click it online. Once they do that, that's when the item gets picked.
You're going to notice on the screen, the associate is provided a picture of the item, a description of the item, and then a quantity of how many they need to pick.
To pick the back massager, a second worker calls the orange robots over, retrieves the massager from a shelf, and then puts it on a yellow tray, kind of like those airport security trays, which go on a conveyor belt.
So the next step in the process is pack. So the next place that we're going to go is to a pack station.
So at the pack station, it's what it sounds like. Basically, the back massager comes in on a yellow tray, and a worker packs it into a box. No robots here. This is the place where someone gets to see all the secrets of what we order online. And today that someone is a very peppy Ashley Vasconcelos.
So what do you have there?
This is a candy cotton machine.
Okay.
Which is awesome, you know?
I want to know, what is the weirdest combo of stuff she's seen someone order?
You know, one time I got a microwave and some duct tape and a hammer. And that was interesting. Interesting combination.
I wonder what's going to happen next.
Yes. What are they going to do, warm up the tape? Or
I ask her, how many items does she have to pack a day?
Well, I know an hour they want us to do about a 63. So that's how many we do an hour here. And so you could do that. We work 10 hours a day.
Workers normally do 4 shifts a week. So if you do the math, Ashley packs around 2,520 items a week. So the very last thing that happens to your back massager is that it gets a shipping label. All of the labor at this point is done by a magical puff of air.
A shipping label is created and gently placed with a puff of air on top of the box. That sound that you hear is a puff of air that is placing it onto the shipping box.
This part, I have to admit, is literally my favorite. So the robots at Amazon, pretty amazing. And on the way in, I pass signs of a mother's room, and there are vending machines that I see, too. They're free to workers with items like earplugs, lotion, Advil. Just this week, Amazon announced that they're raising their minimum hourly wage to $15. But over the last few years, Amazon has been grilled about their working conditions. For example, public records show that thousands of Amazon employees are on food stamps. Amazon says these figures are misleading because they include people who only worked there for a short period of time or worked part-time. And a book published this year by a reporter who worked undercover at an Amazon facility in the UK details that workers often wouldn't even take bathroom breaks because they feared not making work quotas, and that workers were actually penalized for taking sick days. Amazon responded that they didn't recognize these allegations as accurate. They also said they coach people who aren't making the quotas and that their attendance policy has changed. These kinds of conditions are part of why employee turnover at Amazon is very high. While I'm at Amazon, I ask Lauren about this.
You know, we don't have power over why individuals make the decisions they make to stay in a career or a role for whatever period of time they choose to. What we are able to do is provide a great workplace with great team members and great benefits.
A consequence of so many workers turning in and out of warehouses is that it's really hard for them to push for their rights if they have concerns. There are no unionized Amazon warehouses in the United States.
Amazon primarily believes in an open door policy. We believe in the ability to talk directly with associates.
Open door policy, basically, she's saying that they'd rather have employees talk to their managers if they have a problem than work with the union to voice concerns. So, without strong worker protections and in an ever-shifting workforce, are these the jobs that the graduates of Patterson High School really want? I head down to Los Angeles, to a place reckoning with these questions. The Warehouse Workers Resource Center is located in Long Beach. On one side of the room is a wall of photos of workers protesting. On the other side, coffee. The center is one of the only organizations in the country that advocates for warehouse workers. They train people on things like wage theft and how to file for workers' comp for injuries. At the warehouse center, the day I visit is Dwayne Wilson. He's 25, and he drives forklifts for local warehouses.
I like working in a warehouse, but it's not a job that I, you know, pictured myself as a child, like, going into.
Dwayne's been working in warehouses for the last 7 years, after he dropped out of college to start helping his family. His mom got sick, and he helped out paying rent and the bills. The biggest problem for him, though, is the lack of consistent hours. See, Dwayne doesn't work directly for the warehouse. He works for a temp agency. And the agency is supposed to have him working at the warehouse 40 hours a week, but
sometimes they don't let me in. Sometimes they do. Last week, they only let me in one day, so
Dwayne sometimes lines up at 5 a.m. in the morning for a shift at 6 a.m. after being called in and still gets turned away. Sometimes he'll only work one full week a month. Dwayne shows me his phone.
He texted me Friday because I asked him if there was work.
Okay, so you're texting your manager, you say work tomorrow, and he says, not tomorrow. And you say, can I at least work Friday? Like, can you stick me anywhere? And he says, message me Thursday night to see if I have an opening. And then on Thursday, you text and say, work tomorrow, and he says, no.
Yeah, but somehow
so it's like that, it's like a constant text thread of that, basically.
Yeah, kind of. Yeah.
And as for moving up and getting off the temp hamster wheel, Dwayne says he's never even seen a way to apply directly for a full-time job at the warehouse that he works at. Basically, warehousing companies use temp agencies because it's cheaper. Temp agencies provide a steady stream of labor to warehouses that don't have to worry about recruiting workers or managing them. They take money out of each worker's hourly wage, and Dwayne says his temp agency doesn't tell them how much. It could be $1 or $10. They don't know. And the lack of work or a steady paycheck makes workers less likely to speak up because they don't want to risk sacrificing the hours they do have. In Dwayne's case, he says he'd like to go back to school, maybe become a writer. But that's not in his plan right now.
I kind of miss going to school. I feel like the things that they had us do I wish I didn't complain about, because it doesn't seem so hard or so difficult anymore.
Temp work in all sectors is one of the fastest growing industries in the economy. It's hard to know exactly how many warehouse workers are temps, but we do know that companies like Amazon temporarily hire hundreds of thousands of seasonal workers for the holiday rush every year. And these are the trends that Celine Perez has been watching since the 90s. She's the co-executive director of the Worker Center, where I meet Duane. She says companies seek communities that will work for a low wage. But ultimately, Celine does see potential for making warehouse jobs real middle-class jobs if people just organized for better worker protections, because it's happened before.
In the United States, everyone tries to talk about the heyday of manufacturing jobs and we have to bring manufacturing back, which I think it's not realistic. But it's also remembering, because folks say those were great jobs, they weren't initially. There was a long fight. So I believe the same thing for warehouses. They're not going away. We're seeing an increase of e-commerce. They're not great jobs, but we need to make them great jobs.
Back at Patterson High School, the teachers tell me that they don't necessarily see a warehouse job as an end goal for their students. They want them to get promoted or use this job to help them pay for college. Larry, the forklift teacher at Patterson High School, tells me that his goal is to definitely keep students away from temp jobs.
They will start as an entry-level position, but their progression as to get further and higher up in the industry will move that much faster. As far as temp and full-time, we're trying to get them in as full-time, permanent full-time with benefits from the get-go.
But there's only so much he can control, or anyone can, over an industry that has a somewhat disposable workforce. Even Larry, he spent over 20 years in the industry, doing every job there is to do, only to be unceremoniously pushed out.
In my experience, my personal experience, I was just a number. 21 years after I was in my one company that I was working with, they basically gave me an offer, either go to a permanent night shift or take a severance package. So I took the severance package and I went somewhere else.
So I ask him, is he worried then about teaching kids to do a job where workers are maybe just a number on a budget line, regardless of their skills?
But you also had the skills too, right? Like you had been in the industry for like 20 yes. years and that didn't protect you.
Yeah, it didn't protect me, but, you know, I can at least pass on some of those skills to more students to give them the opportunity to walk into a job that's going to be paying them something, even though they may end up being a temp.
After his shift ends at Crate and Barrel, I meet up with Manny again, the former Patterson student who I interviewed in his car. He's a little tired.
How was work today?
Stressful. Every day, yeah. A lot to take in.
Every day when he gets home, he has to recharge quickly and then get ready for night school. He's working full time right now and going to class 4 nights a week. His dream is to one day go to college, to Cal Poly specifically.
Which is a famous engineering school. It's top one here in California. So I want to be like a civil engineer.
He wants to buy a house one day, a two-story house.
Or even a nice one-story. Yeah. But I want to live like on a ranch, like really not too isolated, but having a good plot of land. Hopefully have a boat.
Manny's job as a warehouse picker has been good for him, for now. But it's just a stepping stone, a hustle. It's not going to provide the future he sees for himself.
Thanks, Sophia, for that story. And this segment was reported using research conducted for Latino USA by the Community Service Society of New York. You can find more information about these trends at ccny.org/LatinoUSA. Now, if you've been watching or listening to the news or been anywhere near a television set over the past week, then you've probably heard or seen this.
The truth. What you are doing is allowing someone who actually violated a woman to sit in the Supreme Court.
This is the voice of Ana Maria Archila, who, along with another activist, Maria Gallagher, intercepted Republican Senator Jeff Flake on September 28th, while he was in an elevator in a Senate office building. Flake had just announced that he would vote to confirm Judge Brett Kavanaugh to the Supreme Court.
A young girl, what are you doing, sir?
I was sexually assaulted.
The two women demanded that Flake consider what his vote would mean for women who, like them, had survived sexual assault.
You're going to ignore them. That's what happened to me, and that's what you're telling all women in America.
Later that same day, Jeff Flake backpedaled and asked for a delay of the Senate vote on Kavanaugh's confirmation, asking for an FBI investigation. The clip of that exchange in the elevator, though, ricocheted across the news and social media, and it became emblematic of a moment in our national conversation when many women are demanding that their personal experiences of sexual assault be taken seriously. So right after the incident, we reached out to Ana Maria Archila. She's a Colombian immigrant who runs a national nonprofit organization called the Center for Popular Democracy. And in our conversation, we learned that Ana Maria Archila had actually been preparing for that moment for most of her life. Hi, Ana Maria. Welcome to Latino USA.
Thank you so much.
So on September 28th, you made a road, a beeline, actually, to target Senator Flake. And as a result of that, you made a narrative road that nobody could have imagined.
So the story of Friday begins many months ago. The Trump election, I think, just created a sense of kind of unveiling of the ugly underbelly of the country. My organization, the Center for Popular Democracy, which is a network of community organizations, had been training people across the country for months in this tactic that we call bird dogging.
Bird dogging.
Bird dogging.
What?
It's bird dogging, apparently, is the name of this tactic where you just force human interaction with an elected official. You just show up at their offices and you say, hey, I'm here. I want to talk to you right now. I know you're there. Let me tell you my story right now.
And you learned how to do this? Somebody?
A colleague of mine, Jennifer Flynn, she's the one who taught me about bird dogging. And she went across the country training people. She sent emails to her friends and said, if you can put 15 people in a room, I will come to you and train you on bird dogging tactics and civil disobedience.
Do you remember the thing that you remember the most that impacted you when you first experienced bird dogging?
A colleague, his name is Addie Barkin. He was diagnosed with ALS, and he went to D.C. for the first time to fight the tax bill to tell his story. When Addie was flying back home to Santa Barbara, where he lives, he bumped into Senator Jeff Flake on a plane, and he bird dogged Senator Flake in that plane.
So what happens? What should I tell my son, or what should you tell my son if you pass this bill and he cuts funding for disability?
And told him, said, Senator Flake, I am dying of ALS. If you vote for the tax bill, you will take away my disability payments. You will take away my health care, and I will not be able to be around for my son to grow up. I need you to be a hero. And that moment, that interaction went viral.
Next guest made headlines when he confronted a Republican senator on an airplane about the upcoming vote on the latest version of this Republican tax bill.
And thousands of people then began to follow Addie's steps and come to Washington, D.C. To fight the tax bill.
Thanksgiving break, there have been more than 100 demonstrations already targeting Republican lawmakers.
Many of those people came back to join the members of United We Dream to fight for DACA.
Children also known as Dreamers. Well, protesters formed a human chain across Pennsylvania Street, linking arms outside Senator Joe Donnelly's office, like you see.
Many of them came back to join the Women's March.
Organizers were just hoping to get about 200,000, but they've gotten more than 200,000.
To fight against the separation of children at the border. And many of these folks have been in Washington, D.C. the last several weeks, bird dogging members of Congress, following their senators to try to force in-person interactions with them and to tell them their stories.
Why won't you look at her?
We would like to know if you believe survivors of sexual violence.
Clearly, you're okay if a rapist goes on the Supreme Court.
And so that's how I ended up in D.C. this week.
And I'm sure that there are people who are saying, I'm hearing bird dogging and I'm feeling uncomfortable. Is it about confronting, jumping, taking on, being confrontational?
No, it's not about being confrontational. It's about seeking connection. It's about allowing elected officials to remember who they represent, to connect their humanity to your humanity.
Look at me when I'm talking to you. You're telling me that my assault doesn't matter, that what happened to me doesn't matter.
I was asking myself the question of whether I wanted to tell my story or not. And in that moment, I just went with it. And I said, you know, I was 5, he was 15. And I shared at that time when I was 5 with 2 adults, not my parents, who either didn't believe me or didn't know what to do with that information. They never did anything. So then I just understood the lesson that we are not believed. And this boy understood the lesson that boys will be boys. And I don't want my children to learn that lesson. I want to believe that in our country, we actually listen to survivors. It was a very painful moment. I cried after because I realized, oh my God, maybe my father will hear it this way. Maybe my mother will hear it this way. And then it didn't reach them. But then on Friday, I texted my dad right after the interaction with Flake, and I said, you might hear something in the news. I want you to know that I am okay. And he said, I'm sorry, I was not able to protect you. And I said to him, it was not your fault and it's not my fault. And I feel very supported by you. But you know, that fear was confirmed. I didn't tell my story because I didn't want him and other people who love me to have to hold that pain. And I'm not doing it alone. Like, I'm doing it with all these women. I feel so much in community with thousands of women I have never met, but whose stories I deeply, deeply understand.
When you see what happened in the moment with Senator Flake, how do you connect that to the kind of activism that you've been doing and developing on immigration? How do those two worlds come together in that moment for you?
A lot of the conversation about survivors has centered or the stories of women kind of without talking about the rest of their experience of who we are. I can't separate me being a woman from being Latina, from being an immigrant, from being a mother, and now accepting and embracing this other part of my identity as a survivor. I think the history of this country is a history of the struggle for inclusion, of more of us and the promise of freedom.
In some ways, the act of bird-dogging Senator Flake, people will say it is your most overt political act. In some deeply human ways, it's the least political act.
Yeah. I think it was the mother in me, honestly, that came out. There is a quote by a Sikh activist, Valerie Kaur. So the mother in me asks, what if this darkness is not the darkness of the tomb, but the darkness of the womb? What if America is not dead, but a country waiting to be born? What does the midwife say? She says, when we are in labor, she says, breathe, and then push. Because if we don't breathe, we die. If we don't push, we die. If we don't push, America dies. But if we push with our labor and our love and our vision, we will bring this country into existence.
Ana Maria Archila, thank you so much for joining us on Latino USA. It's been great speaking with you.
Thank you.
Ana Maria Archila is co-director of the Center for Popular Democracy, a nonprofit national advocacy group. And coming up, a conversation with Supreme Court Justice Sonia Sotomayor, who recently adapted her memoir for young adults.
I believe that people, and that includes children, who live in difficult circumstances need to know that hope is possible.
Stay with us. No te vayas.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and from the Wallace Foundation, fostering improvements in learning and enrichment for disadvantaged children and the vitality of arts for everyone. Ideas at wallacefoundation.org and the Pew Charitable Trusts, marking 70 years of nonpartisan research and data. Learn more at pewtrusts.org/70.
Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. The Supreme Court and the future of its composition and its decisions has been the unavoidable center of focus for much of America recently due to the fight over Judge Brett Kavanaugh's confirmation hearings and the controversy surrounding it. We're going to be talking to a sitting member of the Supreme Court, but a word of warning. We're not going to talk politics about Kavanaugh or his nomination or any of the decisions that are currently facing the court. And that's because a sitting Supreme Court justice is discouraged from commenting to the media about current affairs. But we will be hearing about the life and coming of age of one of the nation's most powerful Latinas. Sonia Sotomayor was born in the Bronx in New York City to Puerto Rican parents in 1954. She was an avid reader and a super disciplined student. She grew up and went to Princeton University and then eventually Yale Law School. She graduated in 1979. 4 decades later, she was nominated by President Obama to sit on the Supreme Court. Justice Sotomayor was the first Latina and only the 3rd woman to ever serve on the nation's highest court. She recently published a young adult adaptation of her memoir called The Beloved World of Sonia Sotomayor and a children's illustrated book called Turning Pages, My Life Story. I sat down with the Supreme Court Justice to ask her why she decided to publish these books now. You know, a lot of people are probably thinking, oh my gosh, you're interviewing a Supreme Court justice. You're going to talk about the news. And actually, there's a lot of restrictions on what a Supreme Court justice can talk about.
I don't comment on any political issues, so I won't talk about the current confirmation process. I also won't talk about cases or matters that might come before a court. And so I'm always hesitant and believe it proper to follow the judicial code of ethics, which suggests that we refrain from commenting on things of that nature. And that's what I don't do.
What you do, though, is you write a lot. For being a justice, you know, you've written, 3 books now. What was it that said to you, okay, let's do a children's book and let's do a young adult version of my memoir?
Well, there is the more global reason. I believe that people, and that includes children, who live in difficult circumstances need to know that hope is possible. The practical reason for moving on to a middle school book and a young reader's illustrated book is that I have a cousin, Miriam. Miriam is a middle school teacher, bilingual education teacher in Stamford, Connecticut. And since my memoir, My Beloved World, came out in 2013, Miriam has encouraged me to write a middle school version.
The young adult book touches on your dad's alcoholism. He ended up passing away because of it. And I guess what struck me was that while you were really sad, and you talk about this after he passed, you also wrote that you thought that your life could get easier. And that was probably a difficult thing to kind of understand and wrap your head around. But so what advice do you have for young people with parents who are grappling with addiction?
Maria, if I could rephrase that question. The question in its greatest essence that's asked of me is, would I have been as successful if my father had continued living? And what I tell people is, I don't know. None of us ever know what moment in our life turns our direction and leads us to one path rather than another. That's because I have a very strong belief that everything that we face in life teaches us something. So having my father's presence in my life for as long as he was there taught me the dangers of alcoholism, but more importantly, the burdens it places on everyone in an alcoholic's life. And I think the first lesson a child living in that situation has to take is that it's not their fault.
So one of the things that comes through in both of these books is your really profound love for La Isla de Puerto Rico, Puerto Rico. When was the last time you went to Puerto Rico? Like, what are the memories? And did those memories help in a way to make you strong enough to deal with these challenges?
The answer, short answer to that question is absolutely yes. Turning pages, the illustrations capture so much of the island. Even on the very first page where I'm walking up the steps of the Supreme Court, Lulu put in some plants from Puerto Rico, and one of the plant leaves
yes.
is a little coqui.
Oh, here's the coqui. I had kind of missed him.
You know, I am a very proud Latina who is very American. I was born and raised in New York. I'm a proud, proud American. But I'm also a very proud Puerto Riqueña. And for me, there is no tension in those two things.
Justice Sotomayor, so in your young adult book, you talk a lot about your experience in college. And you write about the fact that when you ended up going to college, that's where you actually experienced like more specific discrimination. What did your college experience teach you about how to deal with this?
I think I'm often asked, how do you deal with discriminatory moments? And my answer is that there isn't a formula. So I'm going to counter with two examples. When I was a federal judge, I was in my courthouse one day, and I was parking my car in the court parking lot. And when I finished, the marshal on duty said to me, "Honey, you can drive really well." And I looked at him and I was a little stunned. Having a court employee call me honey seemed rather unusual. And I sat there in my head thinking, that's pretty disrespectful. I don't think he would ever call one of my male colleagues honey. And yet, when I sat and thought about what motivated him, I realized, you know, I could tell his supervisor. I could get nasty and say to him, you can't take those liberties with me. I could do any of a lot of different things to embarrass him. But I've realized that he was comfortable with me. And I looked at him and I said, you know, I think if anybody heard you call me honey, they would think the wrong thing. I think it's better for you to stick to calling me judge.
Okay, so that is one example with how you deal with discrimination. You write about this specific experience that you have in law school, and I'm curious about this. So what happens is that a friend of yours invites you to a dinner that's being held by a law firm that is looking to recruit bright
Yale law students to come and work for them, right? And this is kind of typical, but something happens when you're there. So what happened? What was your experience with that law firm?
So that situation was a dinner that was held by a firm recruiting students to come join the firm. And the first question by the partner of the law firm was, do you think you got into Yale because you were Puerto Rican? And I was literally stunned. He had not seen my resume yet. He did not know that I had graduated from Princeton with highest honors. I would think that with all of those achievements, no one would ever ask, was my being Puerto Rican the reason I got into Yale? But it was an assumption he made merely because I was Puerto Rican.
Whoa.
And there was a hearing, and the law firm was censured. And I realized that for those people who can take a public stance in situations like this, they should.
And finally, Justice Sotomayor, just kind of a more personal question, a kind of temperature check. How are you feeling about things? How are you doing?
I thank you for asking, and I am doing just fine. But I do live life trying still today, and you know from our prior conversations that I've always lived life trying to take as many positive experiences as I can from it. So even when the pressures get the greatest on me, I do try to remind myself that living life fully is the only way to truly live it, as opposed to suffering it.
Supreme Court Justice Sonia Sotomayor, thank you so much for joining us again on Latino USA. We're so thankful, and thank you for writing your two books.
Thank you.
Sonia Sotomayor is a sitting justice of the United States Supreme Court. Her two new books are for young audiences, The Beloved World of Sonia Sotomayor and Turning Pages, My Life Story. And they're both out in bookstores now. That's it for today. Latino USA is produced by Miguel Macias, Antonia Cerejido, Maggie Freeling, Janice Yamoka, and Sayer Quevedo, with help from Fernanda Chavarri and Maya Cueva. We're edited by Marlon Bishop and Sofia Paliza Carr. Our engineer is Stephanie LeBeau. Additionally, engineering this week by Rebecca Weinman. Our production manager is Natalia Fidel-Holtz. Our fellows are Virginia Lora and Jesse Alejandro Cottrell. Our interns are Paula Mora and Comis Johnson. Fact-checking this week by Julissa Treviño. Our theme music was composed by Zenia Rubinos. And if you like the music that you heard on this episode, be sure to stop by latinousa.org and check out our weekly Spotify playlist. Join us again on our next episode. And in the meantime, look for us on all of your social media. Y ahí te veo. Chao.
Latino USA is made possible in part by Deutsche Bank America's Foundation, the Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide, and by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
Sonia Sotomayor.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and from the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, whose Clinical Scientist Development Awards support promising early career physician scientists and their research efforts to improve human health, and the Gruber Family Foundation, supporting NPR's international coverage, covering the trends, moments, people, and movements that drive the world, always with the goal of creating a more informed public, one challenged and invigorated by events, ideas, and cultures. This is NPR.